It's not your life. The client's life isn't your life. It's what they do, it's what they choose. And the more neutral you can be in your conversation with clients, I think the more your clients will experience your trust and will experience their own capacity to make choices free of interference. So I think that is a tough discipline to develop, but really, really worth it.
That is Simply Focus with Every Journey and Dominic Gooder for live and joy and ease.
We've got a brand new exciting episode for you. Please welcome your host, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Welcome back, everyone, to episode number 77 of the Simply Focus podcast. And we are in London with Chris Iveson today. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hi, Dominic. Hi, Elfie.
Thank you so much for having us here in your beautiful house in London and for spending time with us, being with you. It's always a very joyful thing. And it's lovely to see you and Bibi together. So, yeah. Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
We really enjoyed yesterday evening. We had dinner, beautiful dinner made by Chris, and really enjoyed the time with you and your wife, Di.
We met you for the first time a few years ago in Vienna and had the joy of participating in a workshop with you. And for me, participating in this workshop with you made a really huge difference because I felt for the first time this freeness of going into detail as much as I want. This is one of the things I truly enjoy. And then, of course, making lists is another thing I very much enjoy. And you really helped me with that to feel more free to do it.
And ever since then, Elf is torturing me with lists. And now, after a while, I really, really love making lists. And we usually do that when we drive. Like someone of us comes up with, hey, let's look for 100 things that have worked well in the last 2 hours, for example. And we drive 4 hours. And these drives that we have really made a huge difference for us and also our relationship. So we have not yet done lists with 100 and more things on it, then start doing them.
Yeah, indeed. But I have to say, I did know of you before I met you because I heard all about you from Susanna Bergstaller, who thought you were wonderful. And then when you got together, she was over the moon.
She will love to hear that.
Chris, you're co-founder and the trio at Brief with Evan George and Harvey Ratner. And all the people we met in the UK, they mentioned you and Brief because they learned Solution Focus through you. You brought Solution Focus to the UK and have influenced so, so many people over the last 30 years. You have written books, In a 90s Problem to Solution, Brief Therapy with Individuals and Families, and Whose Life? Community Care of Older People and Their Families. And 7 years ago, Solution Focus Brief Therapy, 100 Key Points, and Brief Coaching. And those two books really influenced our practice very much. And you sometimes tell the story that you learned Solution Focus through reading Steve's books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we first learned the brief way of Solution Focus through reading your books and then getting to know you. So then whenever you tell the story, I'm like, oh, that sounds a little bit similar to what we experienced reading it first and then seeing people who wrote the books really doing it. It's really amazing.
It was like we were talking last night about cookbooks, recipe books. And one of the big criticisms of Steve's writing was that he just wrote like cookbooks and you can't teach therapy like that. And we knew you could because that's how we'd learned. And so we wanted our books to be books you could learn from.
Well, you did a great job with that. So thank you very much. You're on your solution-focused journey for over 30 years. And what is it that fascinates you with solution focus?
Well, it's a mystery, really. When we started, we thought this is so simple. Maybe we'll be able to do it for 5 years and then we'll get bored. That was the plan back in 1987, 88. But it's been a constant fascination. And we have sort of thought about it, talked about it, done it, developed it. And I suppose our big passion, particularly my big passion, has been to simplify it, to keep that process that Steve DeShazer has started of always looking at what you're doing. Is it necessary? Checking out, dropping it, seeing if it works. And I think that's been a driving force for us. So every time we sort of pause and look, it's a little bit different. Sometimes call ourselves minimalist. It's not the sort of minimalism that's usually thought of in relation to art, which is a trying to get to the essence of things. With us, it's a sort of more dynamic minimalism. So you take something away and it doesn't reduce what you've got. It opens a window on something that you couldn't see before. So every time you make a change, you see a different horizon. So it's a constant process of change. That's been a fascinating thing, really, that when you do something different, it shows you things that you couldn't see before.
And with that way of looking at your practice, you develop things like the best hopes question, like the tomorrow question, like finding out that, well, tasks are not needed, for example, like those experiences with lists and so many more things that are so influential in our solution-focused world.
Yeah, accidental in one sense. Not accidental in that we weren't accidentally striving to develop it, but that the best hopes is a question that sort of evolved. We don't actually know when it started. The list was a specific, again, a fluke. None of these things might have lasted if we hadn't been talking to each other all the time and talking about what we did. So rather than the lists were just a one-off thing with a particular client, and it worked, but we never thought it was anything to do with the list. It was only much later on. In fact, Yasmin Ajmal saw the tape of this list session and thought, oh, that's a good idea, and started using lists, then started talking about them, and we ignored her for about a year because we thought, oh, why would you want to do lists? And then eventually I thought, oh, I'd better try one of these lists that Yasmin's talking about. Had this massive effect. I told Yasmin, look, I'm very sorry, Yasmin, that I've ignored you over these lists. It's brilliant. And she said, what do you mean? It's your idea. And she thought I was using them all the time.
So what is it that keeps you fascinating with lists?
Oh, well, I hardly ever use them. I use them more on training. They began as a training exercise to practice what else? That's how they actually began, just as a training exercise. Then when I was stuck with a client, the only thing I could think of was to get him to do a list. And it had this dramatic effect. But then I say it was another 3 years before I did the next one, having learnt how to do them from Yasmin.
Oh, that's the wonderful thing of mutual influence. I really love how you highlight that the things you develop, it's not something that happens, you know, in the silent room, but it happens in your conversations. And I think this is also how you got into solution focus, the three of you.
Yes, well, we could have become narrative therapists. It was potluck. We were family therapists, and part of our job was to teach family therapy, and solution focused and narrative therapy both appeared in the family therapy journals about the same time. And we thought, well, we'd better teach ourselves how to do these. What should we do first? And Harvey and Evan were doing quite a lot around the MRI at that time, so solution focus seemed an obvious. So they actually started it, and I kind of jumped on the bandwagon. So we had a 3-month project, an afternoon a week, seeing three clients, one with the client in one side of the screen, the other two with a book. First of all, Keys, and then Clues came out. This is in 1988. And after 3 months, we found we couldn't do anything else, and we were stuck. We had to really give up our family therapy teaching, which was a big shock, really, to us and the family therapy world. They thought we'd gone mad. But luckily, people got word of solution focus and started to ask for training, so we became Brief.
So what was it that changed for you in those 3 months?
It was, like a lot of people, a sense of coming home. This is what I've been looking for. This is so familiar. I mean, I'd worked really hard throughout. I was a social worker. I hated the pathologizing of clients right from the word go. But there wasn't any schema that wasn't pathologizing. And family therapy came along, and the early family therapy was very exciting, non-pathologizing. So that was maybe my first therapeutic love, and I thought it would last me my entire life. But family therapy then develops its own pathologizing language, and solution focus came along, and that just fitted. And the idea of exceptions was such a brilliant idea, such totally game-changing, this idea of exceptions. Even though we hardly ever use exceptions in our work now, it's a sort of fundamental pillar of it all, this idea that there's always solutions going on inside the problem. That was just totally groundbreaking.
And you didn't receive a training by Steve or Insu when you started with solution focus. So how did you do that?
We just taught ourselves from Steve's book, wrote our book, invited Steve over to London to do a workshop, which took us a long time to think about because none of our institutions would bring him over. I don't think any of us told our wives that we were risking our family holiday money. And we set up this workshop, and it was a brilliant success. And that gave us enough money to advertise some courses. We showed Steve this book that we'd written, and he was a little bit sniffy about it. We said, will you write a foreword? And in his foreword, he says, he was a bit suspicious of these people writing about his work. But basically, they got it right, so it was okay. It's a good read.
And that was probably a massive compliment from him.
Yeah.
So he stayed with Solution Focus over all those years, and it has developed over all these years. So what is it that you are currently working on or thinking about right now?
We think about these things and we talk about these things, and eventually sometimes we write about them. So I've just been writing something about the value of trying to be neutral in our conversations with clients. So by that I mean trying to do whatever we can to open up possibilities for the client, but being neutral about what they actually do tomorrow. So what the client actually does with their life is not our business. Our business is to open up the possibilities for them so they wake up the next day with more choices than they had the day before. And then it's up to them, you know, what choice they make. And it's hard because obviously for much of our life, being successful was necessary to our livelihood. We had to do successful therapy. So to be neutral at the same time as needing to be successful is a bit of a paradox. So at one level, obviously, we want our clients to have wonderful lives. We want their problems to be resolved. We want them to be happy. We want them to make the choices that we think they should make, all those things at one level. But actually sitting in the room with a client is a discipline, which means that you don't always achieve it. I mean, any discipline is called a discipline because it's hard to do and sometimes you mess up. But the discipline is to be neutral about what the client does tomorrow.
And how do you do that in a session?
Well, I try and do it by simple things like not doing summaries, compliments, tasks, not even summaries, which is a bit extreme because most people, even if they don't give tasks, even if they don't give compliments, might give a summary. But I think if you're giving a summary, you're highlighting the things that you think that come from your value base. So I would see it as an attempt to influence the client in what they choose to remember, what they choose to think. So I think keeping away from that, not being too enthusiastic about when a client gives an answer that you like, just trying to be non-committal about what they do. I mean, happy to hear them talking about being happy, but in a kind of human way. So I'm not talking about being a kind of emotionless, robotic neutrality, but just keeping in mind that what your client does tomorrow is their business, not our business.
It also sounds like the shift you made from next steps to signs of progress, kind of noticing things mm-hmm. that might be different that go in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And also with the argument of not deciding on one next step that maybe the therapist likes too. Uh-huh. And with this opening up the whole range of possibilities
yeah.
and being neutral in a sense of not, let's say, forcing a person to have a next step and to do something.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, this goes way, way, way back that we made that shift. Early 90s, I should think, when we were training people working with young teenagers in trouble with the law, where if you set tasks, you set a kind of force and a counterforce. Whereas when we asked them to look out for what might they be noticing if they moved up, then you'd have a whole range of things that may be. And the more ordinary they were, the more likely they were to happen. So one, for instance, which I always liked, a bit silly really, but if anybody has a dog, you'd say, what do you think the dog would notice? Maybe I'd stroke him more. Okay, so if you're stroking the dog more, that would be a sign. Would the dog like that? Yes. How would you know? Because he'd wag his tail. Okay, so when you see the dog wagging its tail, that'll be another little sign. And you know that dogs wag their tails, whatever. So sometimes you can build in signs of progress, which are inevitably going to happen, but they'd be noticed in a different way and therefore have a different meaning. And that really, in a sense, fits with these detailed descriptions, that the more detailed a description you have of somebody's preferred future, the more likely it is to happen. But when it does happen, it'll have a different meaning.
And it's neutral in a sense of that the person going out of therapy, going into his everyday life again, can do whatever he or she chooses mm-hmm. when she sees those signs. It doesn't
yeah, absolutely.
Have a commitment to doing something.
No, absolutely. It's a bit like when I travel a lot for training, and one of the things I do is when the journey starts off, just check the first station that we go through after we leave, which would be a sign that I'm on the right train, because I have been known to be on the wrong train.
And sometimes even the trains you choose don't know where to go. That's a story we heard yesterday.
So what is it about neutrality that fascinates you?
It goes back to part of me misunderstanding Steve DeShazer and what he meant by detailed descriptions of what he called goals, what we call the preferred future. Just that really struck me as a brilliant idea. Subsequently, when I've looked at all the tapes that we have of Steve DeShazer, which is where I got the idea from, he hardly does any detailed descriptions of anything, really. It's very, very cursory. But anyway, back then it seemed like detail. I got into more of this detail. And then what I began to realise is that this descriptions of the future, which were meant just to kind of identify the outcome that you're looking for, just so you knew you were on the right track, it became clear that they had a therapeutic impact in themselves, that just describing the preferred future could seem to have a therapeutic impact. So then that began to lead us to switch from thinking about, instead of the job being to give the client the right tasks and the session being the construction of the task, we began to think, well, maybe it's the conversation that's the therapy, in which case we could test that out by dropping the tasks. I don't think people realize now what solution-focused tasks entail, but to do a really good solution-focused task, you have to start preparing it about a third of the way into your session. So a third of the way through a session, when you're giving tasks, you start having a conversation not just with the client, but with your theory of tasks. And you can see that in all of Steve's sessions. You can see where he begins to think of a task, because his questions are coming from not just from what the client said, they're coming from some idea in his own head. So when you stop doing that, when you don't have a conversation in your head at the same time as you're talking to your client, you're left with just you and your client. And that leaves a sort of, to begin with, a vast space. But as you then get familiar with it and start sort of breathing that space, you start to see things like stars, you see things kind of that you hadn't seen before. The distraction of the tasks were like clouds against the sky. So I got more and more interested in the therapeutic value of these conversations. And the more we got into detail, the more we stopped trying to push clients to go in a certain direction. I think that's when we started to get briefer. Outcomes are pretty much the same, but the work became briefer. And I think this, the idea of neutrality just comes naturally from that. This realizing that the more we keep out of our clients' way, the more they'll get on with business themselves. Mm. It's an element, again, another aspect of the trust, of the absolute trust you have in your client to make their own choices and live with them.
It reminds me of a sentence you said in this workshop that Elfie mentioned where we met you for the first time. You said, our task is to create a home where solutions can arise. And this is on the front of our camper van, a main quote from you. And really creating this home, this space where solutions can arise through being neutral and through not having theories and thinking about theories or thinking about tasks and being distracted, really being with your client.
Yeah. The other thing just comes to mind when you mention the tomorrow question, which is Harvey's idea, that arose partly by us trying to take out the Erickson out of solution focus. So I'd see on tapes and I'd just be saying, let's imagine you wake up tomorrow morning and miracles happen and solve the problem. That's the first thing you'll notice. Instead of this pause and let's imagine and pause and the stuff that Steve used to ramble on about. So it was an attempt to make the question more invisible, and taking the miracle out makes it even more invisible, making it ordinary, making it so the client doesn't remember the question but is more likely to remember the answer. That was where, again, the development of that, keeping it simple, keeping as much as possible of our direct intentionality out of it. So we're not using presuppositional questions. I prefer to say, what might you notice rather than what will you notice. So I'd only use presuppositional questions when the presupposition is valid, like what else, because there always is something else. So it's a valid question. Again, that was part of the simplification. Part of the overall intent is to help people have happier lives, but session by session, conversation by conversation, it's to open up possibilities, not to guide people towards particular choices of those possibilities.
So the tomorrow question really could be seen as, you say, the miracle question without the miracle. Mm-mm. And still keeping all that magic of tomorrow, of different tomorrow, and all those details
in
place.
Yeah. So the miracle question has always just been a doorway into a conversation. It gets misunderstood, I think. The important thing is the conversation it gets to. And we still use a miracle often, partly because it's just a nice idea. It's very, very handy if a client's stuck and can't imagine anything, then you can bring in the miracle. So I've got nothing against it particularly.
I remember a conversation we had with Sarah Smock Jordan in Las Vegas, and they are analyzing the miracle question, Peter Young and Sarah, and Janet Babalus, Sarah Healing, and Jennifer Gerving. And she said, well, it would be nice to microanalyze the miracle question and other, let's say, future-oriented questions. Mm-hmm. And when we talked together, it became clear that the magic of the miracle question, or also I think the magic of the tomorrow question, is not the question, but really afterwards what goes on in the details. And you're master of details. We were so struck when you let us do the exercise where you really go into details how the other person might notice and how you might notice that she noticed and I would notice again that she noticed that I noticed even before entering the kitchen, for example. And the first time I heard about that idea, I was like, this is silly. And as soon as we started doing it, you realize the power of it, especially when you wake up. You will wake up, hopefully, the next day or the other day. And how many things you, on the one hand, see, and how many things of those ideas that I expressed really became reality. Mm-hmm. And those very small little things of everyday interaction that it can lead to really big changes in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
So how did this focus on the detail of the detail and the reaction to the reaction of the detail
It came from Steve Deshaies, a concrete detail observable by others, other people, perspectives, interactional, what happens between. So just following his rules, just following them a lot better than he did.
Taking them one step further at least, yeah.
You just mentioned not asking questions with presuppositions. Mm-hmm. So could you share a little bit more about that? Because I think a lot of people have the idea that we have presuppositions in all our questions. And not only in the what else question.
If all questions are presuppositional, then presuppositional has no meaning. If another one is, I say, well, trying to be neutral, trying to not influence the client's direction, people say all questions are influential. Of course, all questions are influential. But if they are, it's a meaningless term. So clearly what I mean when I talk about presuppositional, when I talk about influential, talking about a sort of finer tuning of the word. So I want my work to be massively, massively, massively influential. Yeah. I want my clients to walk out of a first session into new lives. So of course, what I'm doing is influential. I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't. It's my job. But during the session, I'm trying not to influence the client on the choices they take. So what I see is that the best way I can be influential is by asking questions a client hasn't been asked before that lead them to see the world in a way they haven't seen it before, which means that they can see possibilities that they hadn't known were there before, even though they'd always been there. If whatever the client does tomorrow will have a history going back to the beginning of their lives, so it's always been there, just not being available somehow. And when I think about the whole presuppositions that come from Erikson, like the what will you notice rather than what might you notice, to try and get the client to believe it's going to happen. That's an intentional attempt to influence the way the client thinks about it. Whereas I say, what might you notice? Because it's more conditional. It may be this, it may be something else. I don't always do it. When I look at my tapes, think, oh my God, there I go again. Will. Basically, I don't want to have anything that's hidden from the client. It's the same with the miracle question and as a trance. If a client goes into a trance because of my questions, I don't mind, as long as it's not me that trying to make them go into a trance. You know, nobody really knows what a trance is anyway. I think at any point, a client should be able to say, why did you ask that question? You should be able to explain it to them, tell them why, continue with it or change it if the client wants it. What you're thinking, what you're saying should all be there for the client to see if they want to. Not the clients do, but if they did, that's, I think, what we should be able to do.
And ideally, the answer to the question, why did you ask this question, is that it's asked because it builds on something the client said earlier.
It builds on the client's summary later, but it's also exploring what the client said they want to explore. Mm. Because the opening question sets the whole thing up as what are your best hopes. Once the client answers that, then any question to do with the future and to do with the history of that future the client wants is legitimate. You've got the permission to do it, which is why it's such a brilliant question.
And you really see the differences when you ask questions like, what will you do tomorrow, compared to what might you do tomorrow, or what might you notice?
What might you notice tomorrow, yeah.
Tomorrow.
I don't think I'd even ask that. Well, if it was the miracle question, yeah, I'd ask what might be the first sign. Yeah, people find it very hard to get into the detail, largely because you say, what are your best hopes from this? I'd like to get on better with my daughter. Or what would that look like? And that is such a sort of vast, what does getting on with your daughter, what does getting on with Bibi look like? It looks like a million and one things. Where do you begin? What's the first thing that you'll notice as you're waking up that tells you you're getting on with your daughter? Puts a time and place. And that's the secret to these details, is putting the time and the place, names of people, making it real concrete.
And he even goes so far to ask what time they wake up and kind of...
Yeah, because that it just makes it totally concrete.
And I also loved your remark in this workshop about being careful of going into the private life of the person. Waking up in the morning next to your wife and kind of also being careful there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, men interviewing women, you don't want to kind of follow women into the shower and such like. As I have heard people doing on courses.
And we especially notice that when we work with the leaders in the organization, that this question is kind of a strange question, and kind of breakfast is mostly a safe place to be.
That's interesting, because I wouldn't, in my coaching, unless there's some clear indication that it was going to be okay, I would never start in somebody's home. I'd start leaving home for work. What will you notice as you leave home? Because you don't know whether, if it's a business, whether they want you in their home. And what will you notice on the way home? And if you then get an answer which kind of invites you through the door, going to somebody's home at the end, I'll be looking forward to going home. Oh, who's at home? My wife. Oh, how will your wife know that you've been looking forward to? And then you've got sort of permission to be in. But I think in business relationships, in supervisory relationships, you don't necessarily have the permission to be in somebody's private life.
Yeah, I really love the word permission here. And I think this was one of the Sunday posts of Evan that really made a huge difference for me, where he wrote about asking for permission and asking for permission to the client if it's okay to ask another question, if it's okay to ask this question, if it's okay to learn more about that. And I think this is a very respectful way. And just as you say, you wouldn't start in their home. If it's a business context, you would start with the way to the work and then staying at the workplace. It's like this space where you are invited because you're here, and then there are other spaces where it's, if you're not yet invited, at least it's good to ask for permission.
Yeah.
It also reminds me that sometimes with solution-focused practitioners, we hear that it's very important to ask about the differences somebody might notice that you know well. And on the journey to work, you might be in a bus.
What would people on the bus notice about you that tells them that you're a man, you know, ready for the day or whatever? People say, oh, I don't know. Don't think people do notice. No, somebody was noticing. How would they know? And then you've got these not hugely consequential answers, but they kind of set the scene, set things going until you get to somebody more important, like the receptionist or somebody who's just often a key person in descriptions around changes of behavior at work.
And we never know what difference makes a difference.
No, this
so
is true.
I remember me being asked about the person in the bus noticing, and it was such a huge and important thing that this person could possibly notice that something in my life was better. That for me was much more influential than if someone close to me had noticed. Kind of, they know me, they should notice, but the person in the bus, it's like, oh, if she or he noticed, then wow, then there is a difference. So for us, this really has become interesting to just go with the first person and then go from there, and you never know what the
difference. It's a really important point, because we don't know which of the client's answers are opening up possibilities for them, which is why we have to just plod on, trust that somewhere. I had a guy once who said at the end of the session, he said, it's a really interesting process. He was a guy in a psychiatric hospital on suicide watch, and he's also a therapist. So I was doing this session with him, and he was both experiencing it as a client and as a professional. He said at the end, it's a really interesting process because I only noticed you when you were asking bad questions. My gravestone flashed into my mind at that point. So he was known only for his bad questions. And I asked him what he meant. He said, well, when you're asking good questions, you disappeared. And it's only when you asked a bad question that I noticed you and you're irritating. I said, well, why didn't you stop me? He said, well, I didn't know that it was a bad question until I listened to my answer. When it was too late to tell you, so I just hope that, you know, you'd ask a good question, and eventually you did.
When you talk about leaving no footprints, is this the part you're talking about?
Yes, it's trying to make questions content-free. So we know that the conversational process is massively influential. As you're saying, we don't know, you know, what answers are significant to the client, so we plod on. And neutrality and the leaving no footprints is trying to just stay with the client's content, keep the direction going, which is looking forward to the future, looking back for the history of that preferred future, looking back for the past that fits with that future. Just those questions, teasing out as much detail as we can of the past and the future, and without, you know, trying to hold back from ideas about what we would like the client to do or what we think is best for the client to do, trusting that the process of the conversation will be influential, but the content is the client's, and what the client does with the content is their business, not our business. So questions like Steve always be asking, "Oh, so what are you going to do?" is a question which implies that, you know, we think you need to do something.
So Chris, looking back on the time, over 30 years now working with Evan and Harvey, what is it that you have been appreciating most about your work together?
Well, we've been, I guess, hugely supportive of each other. We've just had a huge amount of fun. Just really, really enjoy being together. We don't spend much time together. Mostly we're teaching on our own. So we can go sometimes weeks without being the three of us together. But when we are together, we just have interesting conversations. Usually they talk about football rather too much, but I can sink into my own thoughts while they're doing that. We've been interested in the same things. We're different. Well, from our perspective, we've got huge differences in the way we work, in what we think is important, in our styles. Probably don't look so huge from the outside. And I know there's a kind of myth that Brief is a single model. There's lots and lots of differences between us, so we can argue. But we've just been very, very creative together. And we all have different ways of looking at things, different angles. Evan is very, very clear when he talks about solution for because Harvey is very analytic. He can really sort of dig down and sort of unpick an idea. So you think you've got a very simple idea and Harvey can sort of break it down into 10 parts and makes you look at things very, very, very differently. I've probably been the most passionate about the simplification process, but we've just kind of supported each other, really. Yeah, we've worked really hard. Not so much now. We did work very, very, very hard over a long period. And it'd been a, you know, massive, huge luck that we came across this when we did, that we were able to set up our own clinic, which would be very, very, very difficult to do now. We just hit it at the right time. So we've had a huge amount of independence for the past 25 years since we gave up real work.
And started to work real.
Yes.
So it's really having three people meeting at the right time, at the right place.
Yeah. What was the nicest thing somebody said about us is Yasmin, who worked with us for 10 years, Yasmin Ajmal. And she said, it's funny having three bosses. But she said, there's absolutely no politics at work. Mm. And which is nice. Yeah.
What a beautiful answer. And I think this is just while putting your differences to work, appreciating your differences and then having fun with it seem to be quite some important resources for a successful life still today.
Every now and again, we have an official meeting once a year or something, and we just end up in hysterics very often. Even though there might be really important things to be discussing, we just end up laughing.
And a very great place to meet all three of them at once is the Brief Summer School, which took place in August this year and hopefully will take place many, many more years. Chris, what do you think about that?
Well, there will be a limit.
From your long experience, and we mentioned many, many things on this podcast, if there's one thing that people should really take away from your journey, from this podcast, from your insights, it might make a difference for them, what could that be?
It's not your life. The client's life isn't your life. It's what they do, it's what they choose. And the more neutral you can be in your conversation with clients, I think the more your clients will experience your trust and will experience their own capacity to make choices free of interference. So I think that is a tough discipline to develop, but really, really worth it.
Mm-hmm. So let's come to the challenge of the week.
So the challenge for the week. One of the things that eventually became apparent to me after many years of witnessing it, but not sort of noticing, is that when you do these detailed descriptions of, particularly with families, of family life, the futures that people want, there are nearly always embraces. Parents embrace children, embrace each other. It's always embraces coming home from work, going off to school. And sometimes, and particularly in single sessions, I began to notice that people were describing an embrace with somebody they're having a difficult relationship with. You could see them living it, and that seemed to have a big impact on them. So from that, we developed a little practice exercise in our training of one person interviewing another about their next embrace with a significant person. Or who's the next person you'll see after this course? Let's imagine it's an embrace which contains everything that's lovable about you and about the other person. What will be the first thing you notice even before you begin the embrace? What will be the first thing you notice in the other person that tells you this is going to be an embrace that captures everything, what that person notices about you? And do a slow motion description of moving towards the embrace and then having the embrace. Making a 10-second embrace, the description lasts for 5 minutes, sort of really stretching time. So here's a little challenge, slightly the other way around for that, is that your next embrace with somebody you love, notice how you show each other your mutual love in the way that you conduct the embrace. Sort of microsecond by microsecond, how you look at each other, how you enter the embrace, how you hold each other, how long you hold each other for, how you come out of the embrace, what happens when you do come out of it. Just notice all those things. And maybe if you get the opportunity to try helping a client describe it, you have some good fun.
Wow, thank you very much for that. And yeah, we're looking forward to embrace each other. And we're looking forward to you sharing what was useful for you on this podcast, sharing who you embraced and how you embraced people. So let us know and share in the comment section of this podcast. Go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 77.
Once again, a big thank you, Chris, for being here with us, for sharing your stories and for inviting us to think of a hug. I just had Bibi in my mind when you were talking, and we're very grateful for all the work you together with Harvey and Evan did, for the way how you spread solution focus and really to see how many people you influence and challenge and invite to rethink things or become clearer. So this is a very, very wonderful thing, and it's just wonderful to see you and also to experience the three of you. So anyone who gets a chance for a ticket to London, come and visit them and come to the summer school, because here you can see the three of them and experience how they do their miracle work. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Alfie, and you, Dominic. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for dropping round to my house.
It was a huge pleasure for us, and we're so much looking forward to spending another afternoon together with your wife, with Bibiana, and the three of us.
So have a wonderful week, and thank you, Chris. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Wow, what a great episode again. Do you also like the Simply Focus podcast? Then help Elfie and Dominic spread the word. Give the Simply Focus podcast a 5-star rating on iTunes, Google Play, and other platforms. Comment at www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast. And then go to this episode.